Caleb. Thank you. It reminded me of school for just a moment. I used to have kids who'd bring these things to school, and when I was using them, you know, somebody else would like be in the back there, and they'd be like, "What is this?" And it's like, "Here you go off." And they play their little games like that. You know, so. Fortunately, nobody had the same controller I had, or you know, I'm sure they would have been flipping through the screen, the slides a lot faster. It's like all over. Oh yes, kids find all cool ways to do things. So. Yes. All right, lessons. You guys had good discussion today. You know, the groups that we were in and floating around, it was nice to see. There was good discussion about this period. I was a little concerned about the betrayal, whether we'd be able to make it last, but you can see in that group in there, they would have kept going right through lunch. So you guys are going very well. All right, I thought when we were looking at this concept, in the wrap-ups, I'd like to at least go through some of the things that you guys discussed, as well as maybe give you some additional things you can look at as well. So I thought while you were going through this today and you were looking at what in the first section about in the garden, it's nice to see when you were contrasting and comparing the similarities between the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Gethsemane, and you're looking at all these similarities and different things. It's also good to contrast, though, what the Apostle Paul brings up about look at what Christ has done for us that the first Adam didn't do. And I always found this little section in Romans 5 fun to look at, because he goes back to the Garden of Eden and he considers Jesus Christ and Adam as like two men who sort of like God has made decisions through these men that have an impact upon all their descendants. So how critical it is to be one of Christ's descendants, to be in his family with him in a sense, versus being with Adam. So he talks about that as one man sin entered through the world and death through sin, and death spread to all men because all men sinned. That this is the But God had treated the creation in such a way that he had already condemned all men to death, even though you didn't necessarily commit the same sin as Adam. So he deals with that because he knows that this is a concept the Jews would be thinking about. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses. Ever before the law was given, death reigned through that whole period, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. So you can see how he's looking at Adam and Christ, that God, in a sense, treated them, as John Thomas would say, like federal heads, that they were like men who were like typical of like what was going to come out of the whole group. So in Adam, then, we had all been condemned to death, even though we really weren't all given the opportunity to be like Adam. You were never like Adam before the fall. You never were. You've already inherited this nature, which is biased to sin. God never gave you that opportunity of being like Adam before the fall. But in a sense, he says, if we were like Adam before the fall, we would have all eventually sinned anyways. That's what would have inevitably happened. So God treated our race in a way in which Adam was a man. Some people call him the representative man, but he was like a typical man, in this case, as a federal head. But what Paul goes on to say is the free gift, what God was going to accomplish through Jesus Christ, is really not like the offense. And this sometimes people get confused in this section in Romans, like, what's he talking about? It wasn't like the offense. For if by one man's offense many died, so one man makes a mistake now, and now many people die as a result of that one man's mistake. Much more the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abounded to the many. So that now he's dealt with the fact that one man dies and all of us will die. But Paul already said, because really death spread to all men sort of in a just way because all men sin. But now what happens in Jesus Christ is that look at the difference with grace. One man now has now fulfilled all the types of the law, and one man has actually demonstrated God's righteousness. And now the gift by the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, has abounded to the many. And so he says the gift really isn't like that which came to the one man who sinned. For the judgment which came from the one offense resulted in condemnation, but the free gift which came from many offenses resulted in justification. And that is really a cool concept, that one man sins and now all the people die, but now you have a case of where all these sins are out there and one man's life can provide forgiveness for all these sins. For if by the one man's offense death reigned through the one, much more those who receive abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. So it's an interesting concept when you're looking at that comparison between the gardens as to what actually is going on. Here Paul deals with that and says, wow, look at the difference in the grace of God. This is going to cover all the offenses. Therefore, as through one man's offense, judgment came to all men, resulting in condemnation, even so through one man's righteous acts, the free gift came to all men, resulting in justification of life. Now, that's not all men in the sense of everybody gets it, universal salvation, but he's talking about the all who are going to be included in the one man. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so also by one man's obedience many will be made righteous. And that's the benefits of being in Christ Jesus. Quite a benefit that we get, quite different from what Adam accomplished in the mistake that he made. I think a lot of you talked about the power of prayer in this section. We were discussing like how prayer can change things, really. That we don't want to ever get into a mindset of thinking that God's in foreknowledge, he already knows everything that's going to happen, and therefore, why bother praying? Because it's already predetermined. And that isn't what you find in the Bible. You don't find a life like that. Sure, he knows in his foreknowledge what will happen, but he's always altering his pathways based on the prayers of his saints, and then he knows in the end what will end up occurring. But don't ever get into a position of thinking that why bother praying, because what's the difference? God's will is already out there. You don't find Bible characters like that. So some of you mentioned things like Moses, how he had prayed to alter the will of God. Some of you looked at other things in the prophets where people prayed. We looked at David when the angel was out there destroying, and David prays and says, look, isn't it enough? So there are Bible characters who realize that God's pathway can be altered at times, which is why Jesus then came to the garden praying, in a sense, that if possible, some of this pathway could be altered. But nevertheless, not my will, yours be done. And so you get that where watch and pray lest you enter into temptation, or you find Jesus praying for Simon. I prayed for you that your faith will not fail. Well, why did he bother praying for him if it's just like already predetermined and you just sort of like passively sit back and watch life go by? That isn't what Jesus did. That isn't what Bible characters do. People that are in tune with God, they pray because pray can make a difference. Remember that prayer, the parable that Jesus told that some people call it the parable of the unjust judge. I think a lot of us have renicknamed it the parable of the persistent woman. Because what was the point of the prayer, or the point of the parable? He taught them a parable that men ought to always pray and not lose heart. And so he gives them a parable about a persistent woman who keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming to this judge. And in the end, he just said, all right, because now it's not like God's not like that, but it's like he was trying to get them to realize that don't give up. Keep praying, keep asking, because God's looking for persistence. That's that parable in Luke 18. So anyways, those are good things. And I think you'll find with Christ constantly saying that make sure you remember that whatever you ask when you pray, believe that you will receive them and you will have them. But that it has to be qualified by the fact that later on, of course, was it James who ends up saying that you ask but you don't receive because you ask that you can spend it on yourselves. So these are not selfish prayers. These are prayers where we're praying for pathways for people, that God will help people and God will affect their lives. So, as Paul would say, pray without ceasing. I think that's actually the shortest verse in the Bible, by the way. It's, if you're ever looking like, where's the shortest verse? Well, in the English Bible. But the shortest verse in the Bible is pray without ceasing. It's one word in the Greek. So you can check that out. But I'm pretty sure that is the shortest verse in the Bible. Yeah, so that's always those trick questions when you get like, what is the shortest verse? And it's like, Jesus wept. No. It's pray without ceasing in the Greek. Yeah, so all right. Anyways, that's... those are all those little tidbits you learn if you're a nerd. So, what about when people fail us? I mean, we have friends. We should have friends. And we count on our friends to help us through life. And so you do. You get good, close friends that can help you or people that you respect. But you're going to find in ecclesial life and family life that there will be times in which people that you highly respected and counted on as being your friends, may fail you. They don't come through for you. I've seen this happen in ecclesial life where sometimes people that come into the truth or people that develop in a community, they look up to a brother or a sister in ecclesial life and think like, wow, I want to be like them, or they highly respect everything that they do. But then what happens as life goes on and you run into an ecclesial discussion, and in the end you figure out like, this person's failed me. They haven't like, I don't respect what they're doing anymore. I don't think they're on the right side of this issue. And sometimes people become so discouraged, they become disillusioned with the truth and almost like walk away at that point because they feel like somebody has failed them. That's not what we want to do. It's good to have friends, but it's also good to be realistic and understand that our friends at times may let us down, may not be on the same side of an issue as we are. And so you have to look at a broader picture of not just human friends, but remember the angels are there. And so you look at this issue of what do? Jesus takes his three best friends and they let him down. They couldn't watch with him for 1 hour. He's hoping that they're going to be able to strengthen him and encourage him through his trials that are coming up. And he's in the garden. He's trying to like look at this issue of can he go forward? Can he face what he's going to face at this point? And they let him down. He also knows that Judas at this point, when we add this into the garden, it's not just Peter, James, and John. He knows that Judas at this point has betrayed him. And that he's now in a league with the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees, and he's going to like try to like find a way to betray Christ to them, and that this is all what's happening. He also knows that Peter is going to deny him at this point. And so Jesus could have like piled up all the bad things that were going to happen in his life and become over-focused on those things to where he becomes disillusioned and discouraged himself and is not able to move forward. He knows that all the disciples are going to forsake him and flee at that point. That's what he realizes. But when those kind of times come in your life, you have to reflect back over the things that we have that are sure, that we can anchor into the truth. And we have the angels on our side all the time. No matter what happens in your life, God is with you. Christ is with you. The angels are out there working for you. And, you know, God was constantly trying to tell his people that he will never leave them or forsake them, even when sometimes our friends do let us down. So what happens at that point is that you have to realize that you can't give up. That's not what we're after. These are times of testing. And so God's trying to find out how strong is our faith. Do we really believe that he can, you know, get us through this? And if you approach it the right way, and you trust in God, what he uses these events for is to grow our faith. These are ways that he isn't just testing our faith. He's actually growing our faith to where we will come out of it stronger on the other side than we ever went in. This is Jesus Christ learning obedience by the things that he suffered. In Hebrews chapter 5, he had to himself learn obedience, and God brought him through these things. So you do. You thank God for the angels that are out there. And look at how the angels helped Christ in his life. He didn't have to just depend on his human friends. God gave him angels. He needed angels because he was asked to do so much. Some of you went back and looked at the angel in Daniel chapter 10 that was able to strengthen and help Daniel through what he was going to experience. Daniel realized some terrible things are going to be happening on the community. And he's praying for like what's going to go on. He had just received the 70 weeks prophecy back there in Daniel chapter 9 and must have been quite confused and disillusioned that, wow, things are going to get really bad. I thought we were going to go back after the 70 years, we're going to all go back to Israel and things are going to be rebuilt and the community was going to be reestablished. And now he's finding out in God's timeline, oh no, things are going to get bad again and it's not going to be what you thought. Messiah is going to come and he's going to be cut off. So you go back and look at how when Jesus was in the wilderness and tempted the 40 days, that angels ministered to him. You find that even when the one was that was tempting him, whichever approach you take, that he knew that the passages were there that, I put in angles again there. That's interesting. I used to do that in math all the time when I was teaching math. I was constantly going from angels to angles because I was looking at angles all the time and that spell checker wouldn't get it. So, it's actually his angels will have charge over you and keep you in all his ways. You can find the passage in John 1 that when he told the believers when he called and he warned them. He said, "Look, at you know, you're impressed at the fact that I knew you were talking, thinking about Jacob back there. But I tell you the truth, you will see heaven open and the angels of God going up and coming down on the Son of Man." And when Jesus' his three friends let him down, of course, that passage in Luke is so good there that God sent an angel. So God did what he could for his son. You're going to see this even in the crucifixion. I really think when you start looking at the darkness that you're going to find out that although we tend to think of darkness in a negative way through the scriptures, I really believe that when Jesus was talking to his father and praying for help up on the cross, that God did what he could and he sent the darkness. And Jesus didn't view the darkness as like we might, like I'm in a dark place. He viewed the darkness as an awareness of God's presence that had come down. I think that's Psalm 18. You'll see that when we look at that tomorrow. That God did what he could. He couldn't change the pathway. He wasn't going to change and alter this. But he brought the darkness. He scared away all those that were reviling him. And he gave Jesus an opportunity to deal with the thief on the cross during the period of the darkness. So that'll be fun to watch and talk about tomorrow. But that's what angels do. They really are ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those that are heirs of salvation. And you can see, just like David said in Psalm 34 when he was going before Achish, that the angel of the Lord doesn't camp around those who fear him and delivers them. So you can have confidence when you go forward in your life today and you're going through challenges and trials yourselves. And even if your friends let you down and you're not getting the hope, the encouragement that you thought you could get from them, don't forget the angels are with you. They're there to help you, and they will encamp around all those who fear him and deliver them. Or as Asa was told, that the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the good and evil, and they are surrounding those who really do fear God and whose lives are in conformant with God. I thought it was also interesting to look at, as a contrast, this concept about the will of God. You know, as you're going through all those passages, we looked at all the ones about how, going through the workbook, all the passages about the will of God, you know, that he was sent to do the will of God, and it was good to compile all those passages. It's also fun to watch in relation to our classes in the evening when you're looking at God's plan of redemption, that Paul, when he deals with this in Hebrews chapter 10, makes a big issue out of this will of God. And he contrasts the fact that look at what the law did. The law was a shadow of the good to come, not the very image, and it could never, with those sacrifices which they continually offered year by year, make those who approach perfect. They never could, because you might have thought, like if you're a good keeper of the law, you might think like you do the sacrifices, you go through the motions, and now you're clean under the law. You've been covered. All right, but then what would happen is at the end of the year, every year, on one day of the year, the Day of Atonement would occur, in which you remembered all the sins you had ever committed. And again, they were brought to light. And you think, all right, that year, it's piled up on the animal in a symbolic way, and the live animal carries them away, and you think, okay, we're all right. But then next year, you did it again, and again, and again, and again. And there never was a point at which you were really freed from sin. So that's the problem that Paul says with the law. And you know, if you were freed, then it could have ceased to be offered, but it never happened. For the worshippers, once purified, would have had no more consciousness of sins, but they did. But in those sacrifices, there's the reminder of sins every year on the Day of Atonement. It was not possible that the blood of the bulls and the goats could take away sins. But in Hebrews 10, he goes on to describe, look at what we have in Jesus Christ. Therefore, when he came into the world, he said, sacrifice and offering you did not desire. Oh, no. He realized this is not about animal sacrifices. This is about somebody living this in their body. But a body you have prepared for me. And burnt offerings and sacrifices for sins you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come, and the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God. This is what Christ realized it was all about. That's why you have thy will be done. This is the prayer of the garden that's going on, this war between his will and God's will. And he understood all along this wasn't about sacrifices and offerings. He had been brought into existence to perform God's will, to show the world that sin must be crucified, that this is the war that's going on with the devil, and never give in. Somebody had to establish God's righteousness. So previously saying, sacrifice and offering and burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire nor had pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. And he takes away the first, all those animal offerings, that he may establish the second. This issue of trying to get people to see that it was all about doing God's will. That was the point behind putting your hands on the animal and killing the animal and putting it to death and saying to God, I'll do your will, not my own. This is what Messiah will do. It was always about doing God's will. And by that will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. It was all about the will of God, doing His will. Christ did it. And now when we identify with that in doing God's will, we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus. So this is really what it was all about. Now, I also noticed some of you had some time to talk about helping others and their needs. And it really is one of those topics that would be good to have discussion about periodically in ecclesial life or in CYC. How do you help people going through troubles? We don't help them just by cutting them off. We want to help them. And we also don't help them by just saying, read the Psalms. That's not a solution to people that are going through trouble. We have to, a good lesson to do in ecclesial life for young people is to talk to somebody who has gone through severe troubles, people that have gone through severe trials, and ask them, what did you find helpful? And don't just do it with one person, do it with multiple people. So, because what helps one person doesn't necessarily help another. And so you have to get to know people, you have to get to find out what helps them in their problems, and then you can become an effective helper in your families and your ecclesias. Because then you'll have some tools in your pocket that you can pull out. So when you talk to somebody who's gone through a severe problem, they've had a bad accident, or maybe they've lost a loved one, you now have some options to go to them and listen for a while to what they have to say, and then try to help them through their troubles. That's what you see with Job's friends when they came to him. The first few days they just sat there and sat in silence, and they were great helpers at that point. But as soon as they opened their mouth, it all fell apart. And that's a warning to all of us that we have to be really careful about what we say when we go to help people that are going through troubles. I noticed in my own life that's one of my greatest weaknesses. I didn't know how to help people. I studied the Bible. I thought I'd go in there with all these Bible answers and found out that it really wasn't helpful to a lot of people. And the best thing you can do is listen to folks who have gone through problems, find out what was effective for them, and then have those tools available when you go to talk to somebody else. I also thought you guys did a good job of talking about Judas versus Peter, when you were looking at the betrayal section, that really the two of them are not really on the same page at all. One of them, when you look at Judas was never on board with Jesus' mission, really. I think he got called into this and became, right away he's looking at what he can get out of it. That's what he's in it for. He's in it for himself. And it could be, you can see from the money aspect, that he was always concerned about, having access to some of the money in the bag. My guess is he was probably a political Zionist. I think he was probably one of those people today that was into Zion and into the Jewish community and really, really big on the fact that he's going to overthrow the Romans and now we're going to have positions of power and we're going to have Israel back as a kingdom. And then he becomes really disillusioned with Jesus when he starts talking about his death. He starts talking about his burial. Woman comes and starts wiping his feet, preparing him for his burial, and Jesus says this was a good thing instead of money from the ointment. This isn't what Judas was expecting at all. I really think he can also build a case that at this point in time, Jesus is also changing his ministry and including Gentiles galore. He's opening up the door to the Gentiles. What is he doing, healing a Gentile woman's daughter? What's he doing feeding these Gentiles? What's he doing with all of this? And in John 12, he starts, the Greeks come to the feast, and Jesus says, this was what it's all about. My hour has come of bringing the Greeks in and uniting the family. John 10, other sheep I have that are not of this fold. Judas is listening to all of this and watching it and realizing, what's the matter with this man? He's not on board at all with what we were hoping for. And I think he probably was looking at all these different things Jesus was doing and realizing this is not what he was in it for. But Peter, on the other hand, he was a faithful person. He was part of the community. He's part of God's family, and he fails in a moment of weakness. But the great news is that when we're like Peter's, that God can deal with that, and he can bring us back into the community. He offers us opportunities to return back, and you can come back a stronger believer than you were before. That's the great thing about our mistakes. God can use those mistakes that we make to turn us into better people of faith, stronger faith than we were before, because our faith used to be in our own confidence, and now we learn to have our confidence in God. And that's really what he's after. So some of the lessons you can pick up today, you know, prayer is powerful, so pray in all circumstances. Let's thank Jesus for his victory, you know, victory that he won over sin in the garden and then on the cross, and join him in his victory. Be careful, you know, having lots of Bible knowledge like these Pharisees and these other people, it doesn't make you children of God. I think that's one of the greatest warnings to our community today, and especially to those of you guys who come to camps like this. You know, a lot of kids in our community don't even attempt to do workbooks and all those kind of things because they just figure, I can't do workbooks, that's not me. And then we come here, and here you are doing these long workbooks, but you can easily get into this feeling of thinking that somehow this workbook makes me better. I can do the academics of the truth. And all these academics are just so that you can assist the others, so you can grow in faith, so you can help people through their troubles. And there are going to be other people in our community who don't do the workbooks and they don't do all this kind of stuff, and yet they're still members of the body. And that's something you always have to be careful and aware of when you're at these camps. So be kind and patient to everybody in God's family, as Jesus Christ was. And when they struggle, pray for them and try to do what you can to help. And be prepared yourself that you may have to go through some really extreme trials. All God's children do. Just because we're doing it and we're on track doesn't mean that life is going to be easy. And I really think it's important when you go back home is to get to know God's family really well. Know your ecclesia, know God's family members, so you can help them in their times of need. You can't help people going through trials if you don't have a relationship with them. That's one of the greatest things I discovered about helping people who go through real problems in life, is that if we don't know them really well and we haven't developed a relationship with them ahead of time, you are not going to be an effective person helping them in their time of need. And let's make sure we commit to God like Peter, and God will help us through our weaknesses and our mistakes. That's the great thing about our God. And now the time is to go home and put it into practice. This is not just an academic study where we go home with lots of marked up Bible passages and all these cool things marked in our Bibles and all this knowledge that we've learned. This is now God expects us to go home and put it into practice, because those that are born of God practice righteousness, and we don't want to be those who practice wickedness. This is supposed to change our life. And in 1 John, I love that passage in there because it's such a clear concept to him. This is like you're on a sports team and you choose to either practice one way of life or you practice the other. But it is practice. We have to practice these things when we get home. They're just not automatic. You have to work on them every day, take up your cross daily, and follow him. So I'll leave it at that. And it's all yours, Trevin.